206115, Vivian Jane Umphress versus City of Memphis, Tennessee. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Roberts for appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. I've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm Christine Roberts on behalf of the City of Memphis. In this appeal, the City of Memphis asked that the Court vacate the jury verdict against it. The jury awarded damages to the plaintiff, Vivian Umphress, for deprivation of liberty without due process and for ADEA retaliation, despite the fact that there is not even an arguable due process violation, and despite the fact that the trial court improperly excluded evidence that would have negated any causal connection and would have reduced any possible damages to a nominal amount. I'll begin with the Section 1983 claim. Plaintiff has no standing to bring this claim. Her Section 1983 claim is that the city allegedly defamed her in a press release that did not even mention her or her job abolishment, which was issued roughly a year after her termination. But what she does not allege is that she ever saw a name-clearing hearing. She therefore does not claim a due process injury. To allege a cognizable case or controversy, a Section 1983 claim must be premised on a deprivation of constitutional rights. The key point here is that there was no deprivation of liberty without due process of law, because there was no request for a name-clearing hearing. This court has repeatedly held that the process due to an allegedly stigmatized, terminated employee is a name-clearing hearing. In this case, no such hearing was ever requested or denied. Absent any even colorable due process violation, there is no injury in fact, and the plaintiff has no standing. This claim never should have gone to the jury.
Well, why didn't you raise it in a 12B6 motion? it seems like it's an element of the claim. I don't know if it's a standing argument, but it seems to me you would have won on a motion to dismiss.
I agree, Your Honor. Trial counsel did not file a motion to dismiss in this case, but this case would have been dismissed had it been brought as a Rule 12 motion. However, this court has been clear in not referring to the name-clearing hearing as an element of a claim. In this court's 2002 Quinn v. Shuri case, for example, the court stated that once the plaintiff has established the existence of all five elements, he is entitled to a name-clearing hearing if he requests one. It is the denial of the name-clearing hearing that causes the deprivation of the liberty interest without due process.
Yeah, but the concrete injury is the injury to your reputation. It's the money damages. I'm just having trouble. What cases do we have where somebody was claiming money and we say that's a standing problem? I mean, for their own reputational injury. I mean, I just don't see how this is standing at all. It's not a bad argument as a 12B6, but we're way past that.
Your Honor, we would submit that there's just no colorable claim here. This is not a situation, for example, where there was a factual dispute over whether a name-clearing hearing was requested or what type of evidence the plaintiff was allowed to submit at a hearing. In this case, there was no case or controversy because there's no due process injury. The due process that is due is the name-clearing hearing. And in this case, there was no such request for a hearing, so there's no due process injury. On top of that, because there was no request for a name-clearing hearing, there was also no final decision on whether to grant such a request. So for this reason, the claim is also not right. And on top of that, Your Honor, this court has never found that a plaintiff has a colorable Section 1983 claim with facts such as these. Here in this case, there was no voluntary stigmatizing statement made to the public in conjunction with the plaintiff's termination. Instead, after her job abolishment, her name and status as a former employee were placed on a list of people who require an escort at City Hall, which was kept in a binder at the City Hall security desk and used by the officers who worked the desk.
A
full year later. Oh, excuse me, Your Honor.
I mean, that seems like that was a pretty good 12B6 argument, too. I mean, the proximity of the press release and the termination. I mean, I'm curious when this one was first raised below.
Your Honor, this was raised, certainly at trial, it was raised as a part of a Rule 50 motion. All of the elements of the claim were raised as a Rule 50 motion, and we would submit that this case never should have gone to the jury because it didn't. There was no evidence to satisfy the elements of the cause of action. In this case, the publication occurred a full year later after the city responded to a.
We've lost your audio. I don't know if you can hear us or not.
Sure. The press release. I can't.
You could suspend the time running.
Yeah, keep it going. I'm kidding.
Okay, can you hear us, counsel? Okay.
Mr. Mitchell, this is Christine Roberts. I'm still connected, but I don't have any audio. I'll try calling you back. Thank you.
Counsel Roberts, can you hear us now?
Yes, I never lost. Oh, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes.
Okay, I think we can resume at this point, possibly.
Marshall, is the owl's not pointed at us.
Oh,
may I resume, Your Honor?
Give us 1 second, please.
I think that's it. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Are we good to go? Counsel, are you there?
I'm here, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, and you may resume. I think you were at about just over, 5 minutes and 10 seconds or so remaining time. Is that about right, Bev?
Right.
Okay. If you can start the clock there or not, but whatever would work. Okay, you may resume.
Your Honor, Honor, no cases of this court has ever found a one-year time lapse to be sufficient for the in connection with or in conjunction with prong. For example, this court held in the Murtick case in 1993 that the loss of a governmental right must occur at the same time as the claim stigmatizing publication. It must be roughly contemporaneous. That didn't happen here. In any event, the plaintiff failed to come forward with proof of damages to support her Section 1983 claim. She testified at trial that she stopped looking for work in April 2016, a full 10 months before the city responded to the public records request for the security binder or issued its press release in February 2017. There is no legally sufficient evidentiary basis for this claim to have gone to the jury. Turning to the evidentiary issues that warrant a new trial on the ADEA retaliation claim, the trial court erred in barring critical evidence that the city sought to introduce related to plaintiff's job performance, and the trial court erred again in excluding after-acquired evidence. These exclusions of evidence were wholly one-sided against the city. The plaintiff was allowed to present her evidence. These inconsistent rulings swayed the jury verdict and affected the city's substantial rights by preventing the city from introducing evidence to rebut the causal connection required in an ADEA retaliation claim, as well as by blocking the city from eliminating the vast majority of any claimed damages.
There was no objection to the inconsistent jury verdict at trial, was there?
That's correct, Your Honor. So we would submit that under Rule 49B4, the court had an obligation if given the inconsistencies here to ask the jury to continue deliberations or to order a new trial. In terms of the evidence of plaintiff's job performance, the trial court excluded any and all evidence from the city relating to plaintiff's negligence in performing her job, her written reprimand, being sent home on administrative leave for insubordination, the fact that more than $750,000 in checks were found in her office when she was on leave, and her placement on and completion of a performance improvement plan. This was detailed in the city comptroller's summary judgment affidavit at page ID 1100 of the record. But the jury heard none of it because the trial court excluded it. In sharp contrast, the plaintiff was allowed to testify extensively about her long tenure with the city, her responsibilities, her promotions, credentials, areas of expertise, and even her own interpretation of the city's reduction in force policy. These one-sided evidentiary rulings began prior to trial at pretrial conferences and on plaintiff's motions in limine, but continued and were made even worse during the trial. The trial court's rationale for excluding this evidence was that the termination of the plaintiff's performance was not performance-based in the trial judge's determination.
Counsel, wasn't that the city's position all along that Ms. Umphress was terminated not for job performance, but for the reasons associated with the reduction in force? And then when she testified, she really didn't provide testimony that went to her performance. She just sort of talked about what her qualifications were and things of that nature. So the city never put the issue of job performance in play, really. Am I right about that?
We would submit that this was a job abolishment, but the city certainly could take performance into account. And in any event, the one-sided exclusion of the city's evidence and the blocking of the city's attempts to cross-examine the plaintiff once the plaintiff opened the door, this is all an error because this court has held it in a retaliation case in which the plaintiff has to show a causal connection between the protected activity and an adverse employment action. The employers noted it's an integral part of the analysis. The Supreme Court similarly held in the Burlington Northern case that the significance of any alleged act of retaliation will often depend on the particular circumstances. Context matters. However, the jury never heard the surrounding circumstances here. For example, the city was unable to explain why it was not concerned about plaintiff's EEOC charges and did not retaliate against her. The first EEOC charge was in August of 2015, which happened after the city discovered the $750,000 in unprocessed funds in the plaintiff's office in February of 2015. But the city didn't take an adverse action. Instead, the city worked with her on a performance improvement plan. When she filed a second EEOC charge in September of 2015, Again, the city did not take adverse action, but instead helped her complete the performance improvement plan throughout October, November, December 2015, but the jury never heard any of this. The city was also precluded from relying on after-acquired evidence, namely evidence of more than $500,000 in unprocessed checks and cash discovered in the plaintiff's office after the abolishment of plaintiff's position. This defense was waived in the city's original answer more than 2 years before the trial of the case, or roughly 2 years before the trial of the case. So the plaintiff has been on notice that the city intended to rely on the after-acquired evidence defense from the outset of the case. The court excluded this evidence because the city's answer to the plaintiff's amended complaint was submitted late. However, this court has made clear that the key question is whether the plaintiff is on notice. I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you. You will have your 4 minutes of rebuttal, Ms. Roberts. We'll hear next from Mr. Horvath.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, if I may begin, Your Honors. My name is Andrew Horvath on behalf of the plaintiff appellee, Vivian and Jane Empress. I'm here before you submitting on behalf of Ms. Empress that this court should affirm the jury verdict and the judgment for two very simple reasons. First, the city waived, forfeited, or otherwise failed to preserve its arguments. And second, in addition to those procedural bars, the city's arguments are simply legally inadequate to disturb the verdict. Because the city began with the plaintiff's Section 1983 claim, I will address that first and foremost. To begin, the stigma plus defamation plus theory of liability under Section 1983 prohibits a government employer from stigmatizing its former employees without due process of law. And yet the city is here arguing that there was no violation of due process of law because, in the city's estimation, plaintiff did not request a name-clearing hearing. But the city has skipped the first essential ingredient and element of what due process is here to provide and guarantee: notice, followed by what the Supreme Court calls an opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. The name-clearing hearing is a procedural mechanism that has been carved out in this realm as the meaningful opportunity to be heard. Never in the history of American jurisprudence has a government been given pass on its obligation to give notice to someone that it has designated a certain way with a charge against them, and in this case, a stigmatizing charge that a former employee was dangerous enough to her former employer and the government that she required security escort inside of its buildings. No one knows what is the
counsel. What is the injury here for the 1983 claim with respect to Article 3 standing?
With regard to Article 3 standing, Your Honor, is that Ms. Umphress was robbed of her good name by the city's wrongful designation of her as a security threat without an opportunity to request a name-clearing hearing because the city did not give her notice when it labeled her and designated her necessitating security escort in government buildings.
What do you mean they didn't give notice of an opportunity for a name-clearing hearing? She never knew that she could go get her name cleared?
The problem is that she never knew she was designated as a security threat by her government until they disseminated it to the whole Mid-South, and she joined in the rest of the population in seeing her name and photograph all over every news channel and major media outlet. The appropriate time...
She could have gone at that point to get her name cleared, couldn't she?
No, Your Honor. The time for the meaningful opportunity for her to clear her name is when she was placed on the list, but that's the publication issue. What happens a year later is a dissemination of the publication of the public document. That security was at all times, from the moment of its creation, and the addition of Ms. Umphress to it was a public record under Tennessee substantive law, always subject to disclosure.
So what happened once the name has gone out as part of the press release, or whatever it was that got her name out into the public, at that point she had no ability to clear her name under your theory. Is that what you're
saying? Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Excuse me. Not a meaningful opportunity. The purpose of the name clearing hearing is to be commensurate with the stigma. The appropriate time when she, as a non-public figure, could have been able to clear her name was before it was disseminated to everyone in the Mid-South. And the statement from the city, the press release that goes with it, the city misunderstands. That's not by itself the publication. That's the explanation of the publication. That statement does not stand by itself. It exists solely in reference to the security list. And so the publication at issue here is when the city added Ms. Umphress to the security list.
So you're saying she had a chance before she got her name put on the list to clear her name. The city should have gone to her and said, we're going to put your name on a list. Can you explain this? Why we shouldn't do it?
At the very latest, when they put her on there. Ideally, before they put her on there, but at the very latest, when they put her on there, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay.
And all of this is to say, this was the position we would have been able to argue in the district court if the city had actually timely raised this issue. And in light of the Supreme Court's ruling at Arbaugh versus Y&H Corporation, the direction to all the federal courts across the country now is when a jurisdictional attack, whether it be standing or subject matter jurisdiction, is lobbied against a plaintiff or a complainant, the court is being given this analytical framework to say, is it jurisdictional in the true sense, or is it an element or ingredient of the claim? And the application of that rule, not just in this circuit, but across the country, is we look at what Congress drafted in the statute giving rise to federal question to see if they explicitly identified something as jurisdictional. If not, it is treated solely as a procedural prerequisite to being able to maintain the action, in which case it may be mandatory, but it must be timely raised in order to be attacked. And that was... That's exactly what the city failed to do here, as the court pointed out during
What do you do about, what about that case, I think it's City of Wickliffe maybe, where the plaintiff didn't apply for a permit, or they didn't apply for the license, or whatever it was, and we said they didn't have standing to kind of complain about that process or that city action. Why is your client's failure to ask for the name clearing hearing not the same thing in terms of a standing argument?
Although I'm not immediately familiar with the case of the court is citing, based on what Your Honor is sharing with me, the difference is in that case there was not the due process violation premised on the government's failure to provide the guarantee notice to the third party, as far as I can understand. That is what's at issue here. And so to the extent that there's any kind of question about standing, the concrete injury, as Your Honor pointed out earlier, is the injury that harms the impairs the reputation of Ms. Umphress. It becomes a 1983 claim when that harm has come about without due process of law. That's exactly what happened here. Continuing on, I'd like to turn to what the city alleges are improper evidentiary rulings with regard to plaintiff's other claim, which is the retaliation claim. In particular, the city complains about exclusion of job performance evidence after acquired evidence, and in its brief, it also complained about matters regarding the reduction of force policy, but that was not raised today. With regard to the job performance issues, for For two years of discovery, we tried to understand what the city's basic litigation strategy was. What is their defense to our allegation of termination? And for 2 years, consistently, the city had always represented to us and to the district court, this is purely a restructure. Over and over in its pleadings and in court, counsel absolutely affirmed this to the district court judge, saying job performance had absolutely nothing to do with the decision to restructure.
I believe your opposing counsel said something about it being erased in the answer. Is that correct?
As to the after acquired evidence, not the job performance, but I'm happy to address that. Notwithstanding the city's failure to timely file an answer to our amended complaint, even if the court overlooks that and was to say that the answer itself, the original answer, gave notice to us of their intention to rely on after acquired evidence, we took that, we propounded discovery to the city, asked them what the factual basis for the defenses were, and who the proponent were going to be. And in response, we got absolutely nothing. And the city knows this, because at a later time, after the close of discovery, they realized they had not given us the sufficient factual basis for them to put on anything at trial about this supposed after-acquired evidence, and appended a declaration to a motion for summary judgment, which was not any kind of basis for the relief they were seeking them, suddenly disclosing what they said was after-acquired evidence, after we raised the issue, is not sufficient enough to either put us on notice or to preserve it for trial. And going back to the actual proof of it, it's not even clear what it is, because no offers of proof were made on anything with regard to after acquired evidence, with regard to what the sufficient deficiency in Ms. Umphress's job performance was. We're at a point of conjecture and argument where they're asking the court to say, we want to do over, our trial strategy failed, let's go back down and try again. But all we can do is litigate against what's been presented to us. We prepared our case according to what they put forward as their defenses. And when we saw there was no legitimate basis for any of the evidence that they were trying to introduce, we moved in limine to exclude or preclude that evidence appropriately. And the district court premised on the representations of the city, we believe, exercised properly its discretion in excluding them. As far as I want to return to one final thing about the Section 1983 claim, because the city raised the argument that there were no damages assigned by the jury and that there was this inconsistency in the jury verdict. As the court pointed out earlier, the city did not object to any perceived or feasible inconsistencies in the jury verdict form. And because the jury did give damages for what was described in the verdict form as damage to name / inability to gain other employment, we submit, Your Honors, that was consistent with what we presented at trial and then represented the jury's finding based on all of the evidence that was surmised. Any inconsistency.
What question, though? They answered no to questions 6 and 7. What is it, question 5, then, the yes answer that it would be consistent with? Or are you just saying that the damage to name or whatever was consistent with the evidence, regardless of what the form says? Because I think your friend on the other side has a point. I mean, maybe, I don't know. Is this 49... B or whatever, is it kind of self-executing? The judge has an independent duty not to enter a judgment in this type of situation. I mean, do you have a response to any of that?
Yes, Your Honor. The 49B only comes into effect if it's a general verdict form. This is a special verdict form. The city knows it's a special verdict form. And until it became inconvenient on appeal to acknowledge that it was a special verdict form, they always refer to it as such. If it's a special verdict form under this court's bright line rule in special ruling from 2017, reiterating they have the affirmative obligation to either object before the jury is discharged or it is waived. As far as what the damage is in reference to, it's not just damage to me, it's also inability to gain other employment. Our reading of the whole verdict form as in total, 6 and 7 themselves, well, at least number 7, which references the ability to gain other employment, is redundant in light of what number 9 allows the jury to fill out. And our position was when the verdict form was read at trial, it certainly could be read as potentially inconsistent. And we realized that, but the inconsistency was not harmful to our client, so we had no obligation to raise it. And so as we are here on appeal and not having the timing waived, we submit that along with all the other matters that were either waived, forfeited, or not preserved appropriately for this court. And even if they have been timely raised, Your Honors, we submit that the law supports upholding and affirming the verdict and the judgment. Thank you for the court's time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Horvath. Ms. Roberts, you have 4 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. None of this court's cases support plaintiff's Section 1983 theory, and none of this court's cases have upheld an arguable Section 1983 claim with facts such as these. No voluntary dissemination, no contemporaneous publication, no damages, no unconstitutional policy or custom. And this court has never imposed an affirmative duty on the employer to apply the employee of his right to have a name clearing hearing. This court held that in Queen and Sherry in 2002 and repeated it just last year in Medley, City of Allgood. In addition, the plaintiff refers to the Arbaugh case, but that case holds that a plaintiff properly invokes federal question jurisdiction when she pleads a colorable claim arising under the Constitution or the laws of the United States. Here there was no due process injury and no colorable claim. As the plaintiff pointed out an offer of proof, the city was not required to make an offer of proof here because the district court's pretrial rulings on the issues were clear and definitive, as well as the court's rulings during trial, that the city was not required to make an offer of proof to preserve these issues for appeal. Federal Rule of Evidence 103B says that the party should inform the court of its substance by an offer of proof unless the substance was apparent from the context. Once the court ruled definitively on the record, as happened here on multiple occasions, both before and during trial, a party does not have an obligation to submit an offer of proof to preserve a claim of error for appeal, and this court reaffirmed that principle in 1998 in the Reed v. Baxter case. So long as the district court is aware of the substance and significance of the evidence, the party has preserved its right to raise issues on appeal. In this case, Ms. Ford's affidavit, which is at page ID 1100 of the record, made the court well aware of the city's evidence. The net result of this is that the plaintiff was allowed to portray herself as a model employee who was terminated without receiving any benefits under the city's reduction in force policy after she engaged in protected activity. This court held in the Kendall v. Local case in 2013 that after questions about admitting or excluding evidence, the fair assurance standard calls for reversal when the appellate court lacks a fair assurance that the outcome of a trial was not affected by evidentiary error. In this case, a review of what was allowed compared to what was excluded makes clear that the court's exclusion of the city's evidence were in error and affected the outcome. Briefly on the after-acquired evidence, that evidence would have been responsive. Unprocessed checks and cash totaling more than $500,000 were found in the plaintiff's office after her last day of employment. Ms. Ford would have testified if she did it in an affidavit, but this is a terminal offense. And again, the jury never heard any of this. Your Honors, if there are two things that the city would urge the court to consider, they are, number one, that this court has never found a cognizable Section 1983 due process injury or found a deprivation of liberty interest claim in a case such as this one with the facts presented here. And number two, the Supreme Court and this court's retaliation cases make clear how important it is to look at the circumstances as a whole in evaluating whether there's a causal connection between the protected activity and the adverse employment decision. The jury never heard those circumstances. And on top of that, as noted in our brief, the jury heard from the court definitively when the court gave the instructions three times that the jury was not to make any conclusions about whether the performance was sufficient, that the plaintiff performed her job competently.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Roberts. We appreciate your arguments, you as well, Mr. Horvath. Thank you for your briefing as well. We'll take the case under submission, and that completes our